Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Caring for Your Bones When You Have Breast Cancer. This is a very important topic, and there are many of you on the call today, and we're delighted with your response. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it's because of that collaboration that we have on the call today over 953 participants. And you come from all over the United States, from all different regions, and we also have international participants from Canada, China, India, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you're really from all over the world. And today's program, this activity, is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen, and we really want to thank them for their support today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I also want to just remind all of you that when you registered for this program, at some point you did receive materials, and in those materials is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to please complete that evaluation form and send back your feedback. It's your feedback that really drives these programs and really tells us what workshops and topics you want us to offer. Indeed, this particular topic was one that many of you have requested, and so therefore we're offering it. So take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. We very much appreciate that. Now, we have great speakers today. I want to introduce our first speaker is Dr. Joseph Lane. And Dr. Lane is Professor of Orthopedic Surgery, Weill Medical College of Cornell University, Chief of Metabolic Bone Service, Hospital for Special Surgery. And Dr. Lane is going to address screening for bone health and risk factors, prescription medication to promote bone health, the role of nutrition, exercise, and calcium supplements, and doctor-patient communication. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Lane.
Thanks, Carolyn. Many of you will be facing or have faced the issue of breast cancer, but that's in the setting of an individual who also has a skeleton and bones which are, in fact, are aging with time and are facing the problems of osteoporosis. And many of the treatments you will hear about will affect the quality and the quantity of bone that you basically have. So our goal today is to make sure that your skeleton stays as healthy as possible during this period of time when you face breast cancer. Now, most people will have a very good bone mass throughout their early adulthood. And at the point of menopause, women will begin to lose bone very rapidly when their estrogen levels drop down. And they can lose 6% of their skeleton or greater period of that per year for a few years, and then it quiets down for the rest of their life. It's this loss of bone that we're trying to protect, and many of the treatments and the activities with breast cancer may influence when that peak takes place. Now, the way we screen for osteoporosis, we look at the individual. There's a thing called the Frax Index, which helps in this process. So people who are at greater chance of developing loss of bone will be women, older women, women who are very thin in their body weight, women who have had a fracture, which is a great marker of inadequate bone mass, people whose parents have had fractures, whether they're smokers, if they've had drinking, whether they've had chemotherapy and some of the drugs that we basically are giving, and whether they've had steroids. Some of these elements will make an indication that you may, in fact, have low bone mass. But the actual way to make the measurement is to do a bone density measurement. And this will tell you the amount of bone you have versus your peers and also versus the ideal standard. And given that information, your physician can tell you whether you, in fact, have minor bone loss, which we call osteopenia, or more significant bone loss, which we call osteoporosis. But any individual with any bone loss who has had a fracture, we would consider this to be a significant amount of bone loss and will need treatment. So I would recommend that at the point of entering into a course of treatment for breast cancer, which is definitely going to affect your bone, that you at least get a DEXA and go through that drill. And if you're at risk, then you should consider a proactive program. Now, there are many things that all people should be doing, regardless of their state, and one of them is adequate nutrition. Women who have a low body mass index or a low amount of body fat and are real thin lack some of the ability to withstand all the requirements for calorie requirements in the body. And the first place the body goes to find calories to keep the heart and the brain and the liver going is the bone. The bone is considered not essential. So nutrition is important to protect the bone. In addition, there are specific things needed by the bone. One of them is calcium and the other one is vitamin D. Now, there is a lot of controversy about the amount of calcium you need, but the bottom line is everybody needs calcium, and calcium will be deposited in pathological conditions regardless of what the level is, so that if you see it, it doesn't mean that you basically have too much calcium on board. There is a specific amount of calcium need, and that's somewhere between about 800 to 1,000 milligrams a day. There is a way to pick the right amount of calcium, and that's by looking at your intact PTH. And if your parathyroid gland, which is your monitor, if the gland is up, it means that you don't have enough calcium. If the gland is down, you have too much. So there are ways for the physician to make a patient-oriented determination of how much calcium you basically need. The other nutrient, which is very critical, is vitamin D. There is barely any source of vitamin D. Salmon, some fish, cod liver oil, and the other source is sunlight. But, you know, today we warn patients not to get too much exposure with sun. So basically, you have to get your vitamin D as a supplement. And the usual amount of vitamin D to maintain a healthy body is somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 units of vitamin D. 2,000, you can be guaranteed it's adequate. 1,000, some people may be on the short side. And there's some interesting aspects about vitamin D. In fact, there is some data to suggest it is protective against a whole series of the diseases, and there's investigation now about the role in terms of breast cancer, and we may hear about this a little bit later on. The third part is exercise. If you don't use it, you'll lose it. The bone has sensors out there. It is feeling what's going on. And if you exercise the bone will be retained. You will not lose the bone. And in fact, if you do adequate amount of exercises, there'll be signals to make more bone. So people who exercise actually have a much better skeleton. There are other virtues of exercise. They prevent falls, which are the main source of getting fractures, and they also improve your muscle mass. And the muscle and the bone is very closely linked. If there's a lot of muscle around the bone, there's going to be a lot of bone. So the stronger you are regarding any exercise, the more bone that you will basically have. Now, in terms of treatments and for patients with low bone mass or concerned that they're going to lose bone, there really are two families of drugs. In one drug family group, large grouping, you prevent the skeleton from losing bone. These are agents which go in and stop the mechanism by which bone is removed. And they're usually targeted at a cell, which we call the osteoclast. But there are a lot of drugs that fit into that category. There are things that even estrogen, Avista, or the SERMs, and some of those drugs are used in breast cancer. The bisphosphonates and the whole family of the bisphosphonates, whether they're oral bisphosphonates, such as Fosamax, to intravenous bisphosphonates. And now a new drug, which goes after the signaling of the osteoclast called denosumab, which also has a role in the treatment of breast cancer. And it's interesting that most of these drugs were developed through the course as, and they started their life as anti-cancer drugs. So there's a lot of experience using these drugs for cancer directly, besides using them for osteoporosis. They all are extraordinarily effective in preventing bone loss. But the question is how long and the dosing. And that's where there is controversy today. And in a normal environment, most people will take these drugs for about 5 years. And at that time, your physician should take a good look at what you're doing. And if you have a large amount of the drug and your skeleton is stable, then there's no need to continue at that time, or you can lower the dose. If, on the other hand, you're making bone, then we would encourage you to continue to keep taking this, particularly if you've had fractures. There's another class of drugs which actually rebuild the skeleton, and these are called anabolic agents, and the only one in the United States that we have is a parathyroid hormone, a PTH 1 to 34, or Forteo. But there are, around the world, there are drugs called strontioranilates, which will do the same thing. So now the physician has the ability to either stop your loss of bone, or, in fact, if when necessary, can rescue a bone that is oversuppressed by using these basically these anabolic agents. Now, in terms of you and your physician, you're going to be seeing lots of doctors, and when you have cancer, your cancer doctor, your oncologist, is the captain of the ship, and that should be the person that you address your problems to. But you can speak to things not only about the cancer, but about your general health and general issues. The oncologist may feel very comfortable in answering those questions, but if they're not comfortable or you get beyond a certain point, they are surrounded by an array of very talented colleagues that can also help in that situation. What I would suggest, however, is that rather than going from doctor to doctor, there has to be communication between you and the doctors among themselves. And in the cancer setting, the captain of the ship really should make the major decision coupled with you. So feel free to ask the questions, and your oncologist will rise to the occasion and be looking at your general health besides your cancer. So the bottom lines are, think about your bone health when you enter into a situation with cancer particularly. Look at the risk factors and get a DEXA to make a judgment. Maintain calcium and vitamin D. Develop an exercise program that you can enjoy but will give you a balance and fall prevention and strengthening. And then lastly, remember to talk to your doctor. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lane. Very, very informative presentation. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Jen Rosa Grana. Dr. Grana is Director, Cooper Cancer Institute. She's Head, Division of Hematology Oncology, Cooper University Hospital, and she's also Associate Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. And Dr. Grana is going to address breast cancer, bone loss, and bone metastases, current standard of care and new treatment approaches, controlling pain and discomfort, and clinical trials. It's really my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Grana.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's my pleasure to be here. I liked what Dr. Lane said about the oncologist being the master of the ship. I'd like to think that we need to be playing a very important role in helping to manage bone of the woman, and also in terms of guiding her when other help is needed, and we'll talk about that. I'd like to focus on early stage breast cancer versus metastatic disease, because the issues that we deal with regards to bone are very different, and the approaches are also quite different. In early stage breast cancer, our focus is on maintaining bone health. Despite the loss of estrogen, some women have been taking hormone replacement therapy, and now we discontinue it when their breast cancer is diagnosed. Despite the early onset of menopause that may happen because of chemotherapy, and despite the drug agents that we are using that can harm bone, for example, aromatase inhibitors and chemotherapy, it is very important that we focus on maintaining bone health. We need to focus on both preventing loss of bone, and there's also a question of whether we can be thinking about lowering risk of development of metastatic disease with the use of some of these bone-strengthening drugs. So as we talk about early-stage breast cancer, I want to focus on that. I want to focus on prevention of loss and also maybe begin to think about prevention of recurrence. In metastatic breast cancer, however, our focus is on preventing the complications of bone metastases. If a woman has metastases or spread of her cancer to the lung, liver, but not to bone, we don't focus on bone with bone treatment. On the other hand, if she has involvement of bone, we need to focus on it to prevent what are known as skeletal-related events. What are those? Those are really fractures, problems with calcium management, need for surgery, need for radiation. And we need to focus on preventing these complications. We need to focus on improving survival if we can, and we also need to focus on controlling pain. So there are very important differences when a woman has early stage breast cancer and when she has metastatic disease. Let's talk first about early stage breast cancer. When we think about bone loss, the forces at play in the woman with early stage breast cancer are those that cause bone loss from either loss of estrogen replacement, early menopause that we've caused with chemotherapy, et cetera, as well as I mentioned, the drugs themselves that we use that have an effect on bone. Aromatase inhibitors are probably the biggest culprit. If a woman has a cancer that is estrogen receptor positive, if she's premenopausal, tamoxifen is used. If she's postmenopausal, aromatase inhibitors are used. And the aromatase inhibitors have two effects on bone. The first is they can cause arthritic-like symptoms, so a fair number of women will complain of chronic arthritic symptoms. But also very importantly, the aromatase inhibitors, all three that are on the market today, have been shown to cause accelerate bone loss. So we need to focus on that if a woman is taking these drugs. And I can tell you that up until about 5 to 7 years ago, oncologists never paid attention to bone. But since the onset of the aromatase inhibitors and since the recognition of the importance of bone health, oncologists have been some of the biggest drivers of ordering bone mineral density, monitoring bone mineral density, and being sort of the guardians of this area for the cancer patient. The approach has to be several-fold. We really need to focus in the woman with early-stage breast cancer on some of the things that were mentioned earlier, exercise, calcium, and vitamin D. Vitamin D in particular is very common in women diagnosed with breast cancer. In one Canadian study, as many as 50% of the women looked at were vitamin D deficient, so it's become very commonplace for the oncology team to be looking at vitamin D levels, to be measuring vitamin D levels, and to be increasing doses or replacing vitamin D if needed. It's also very important, though, that we do bone density studies or DEXA scans to assess bone health, and we should do that in any woman who is going on an aromatase inhibitor, any woman who's new to menopause, or potentially any woman who's had fractures before, so we can get an assessment at baseline of her bone health, and then we can determine how aggressive our approaches need to be to prevent loss or to maintain bone health. So to me, the important thing is exercise, calcium, vitamin D, and then testing to assess the status of bone. Once we know the status of bone, we've already heard about the number of agents that are available to treat bone, oral bisphosphonates, Fosamax, Actonal, Boniva. Intravenous bisphosphonates are on the market, Zometa, Reclast. And now there is this new compound, this RANK ligand denosumab, that goes by the name of Prolia when used for osteoporosis and osteopenia. Each of these has to be considered for some women. We begin with the oral agents most commonly. Taking them is important to do so as prescribed because the one side effect that's bothersome with these oral agents is reflux and esophageal distress. So you really need to spend time educating the woman about the benefits of the drug to get rid of some of her fears. If the woman does not tolerate the oral bisphosphonates, then you move forward and look at the intravenous drugs or, again, the subcutaneous drug Prolia. So the question is really, how do you educate the woman? How do you pick the right drug? And it is a give and take between the patient and the physician. I find that I tend to be very comfortable beginning therapy with these compounds and then every 2 years or sooner monitoring the bone density to make sure we're maintaining stability or improving bone. But I often will refer patients, if I feel that this is more than I can deal with, to either a rheumatologist or endocrinologist that can do a more thorough assessment if the patient is not responding to drug therapy like I would like them to do. So, again, as you've heard earlier, it's really important that the oncologist work with other colleagues to make sure that we're achieving the right goal. Now, the second part of this is, in early-stage breast cancer, is there any data to suggest that these bone-strengthening compounds can prevent the development of metastases, both metastases to bone as well as metastases to other organs? And there have been several studies now suggesting that bisphosphonates, the oral or the intravenous bisphosphonates, may actually lower risk of recurrence, and not just recurrence in bone, which one would think of because the impact of these drugs on bone, but also recurrence elsewhere to other organs, and that they may actually improve survival. The original study that led to this research was a study with a European-approved bisphosphonate, an oral compound called clodronate. It's not commercially available in the U.S. But since that original study, there have been an array of studies that have looked at a variety of drugs, including a recent study that reported on the use of Zometa in premenopausal women. Several other studies looked at Zometa, and again, accumulating data to suggest that these compounds may indeed play a role. There was an Austrian study that, again, looked at Zometa, a trial called Azure, A-Z-U-R-E, that looked at Zometa. There's a study not yet reported done in the United States that compared a variety of compounds. So women either got clodronate or they got ibandronate or they got Zometa. We don't have the results of that study. But again, there is now starting to be data, not yet ready to go to the store with, but there's starting to be data that potentially some of these compounds may have a very protective effect when it comes to development of metastases, not just a protective effect on bone. Many questions remain, however, about how effective these compounds are in preventing recurrence, which agent should be used, should it be an oral drug, should it be an intravenous, and also what the schedule should be. So if you're going to use the intravenous compound Zometa, in some studies it's been used every 6 months for 5 years, in some studies it's been used monthly for 6 months, and then every 3 months. So I don't think we have a clear-cut answer as to what the right regimen is, and I tell my patients that it's an evolving field and something we really need to stay on top of. Why not just give these drugs? These drugs also have side effects. As you've heard, esophagitis, esophageal irritation can happen with the oral compounds. But one of the ones that has gotten the most press has been this concept of osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is if a tooth is pulled or trauma occurs, you have a chronic lingering infection and failure to heal. So if you ask women who've been recommended bisphosphonates, many don't take them because of this fear, and I really think it's a matter of education. The risk of osteonecrosis is quite small. And all that is recommended currently is that we maintain good dental hygiene, that we have the woman going to the dentist every 6 months, and that no teeth are extracted if at all possible. So again, I think there is a lot of research that's going to be unraveling over the next 2 to 3 years, and we will figure out how to use these drugs better, but many questions still remain. In metastatic disease, the issues are different. We use drugs primarily either intravenous Zometa or subcutaneous denosumab, Xgeva. The goals for using those compounds, though, are mainly to prevent fractures, pain, calcium problems, and there is some data to suggest that maybe Xgeva is slightly better, but the benefit is not that dramatically better. Both drugs have issues. Both drugs have real benefit when it comes to prevention of these skeletal events, but they sometimes are associated with bone pain. They both have the same feared risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw, and for both, dental exams at six-month intervals, dental clearance before starting are really vital issues. But again, the one question that remains in metastatic disease is how often should these drugs be used? Should, with Zometa, we've traditionally used it every month indefinitely, but will we do just as well if we dose it every 3 months? And should we dose these drugs monthly indefinitely, or should we do it for a two-year period of time and then space it out so that the risk to the jaw is less? We don't know. So even in advanced disease, there's still a lot of research and a lot of unanswered questions that need to be identified. In advanced disease, it's also important to use radiation therapy as needed. It can be very effective for treating focal bone lesions. Good pain control is imperative, either using nonsteroidals such as ibuprofen or others, or narcotics. And there are some interesting radioactive compounds, radiopharmaceuticals such as Quadramet, that can be very helpful at controlling pain when a woman has diffuse disease to bone. So, again, there are many strategies, and I think the key is the oncologist working closely with the patient and then taking advantage of other colleagues such as radiation oncologists as needed, et cetera, to make the right decisions and to pick the right therapies for the particular woman. And I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grant. That was really exquisite, really wonderful, lots of information here. And so now we do have time for questions, and I'm actually going to ask Stephanie if she would bring all of our speakers on board now, both Dr. Lane and Dr. Grana, and we will be happy to take questions from our audience. If you could explain to the audience, Stephanie, how to queue up for questions, and we'll start the questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, that's star then one to ask a question.
And while we're sort of waiting for our questions, there's always a question that comes up, and I'm going to ask that of Dr. Lane. I know, Dr. Lane, you often have talked about the benefits of Tai Chi, and I wondered if you want to say something about that today as well.
Well, the key element in getting a osteoporotic fracture or any fracture is a fall. And the question that most people ask me is, how do I know if I'm going to fall or not? There's a very simple test that you can do in the privacy of your living room. You can stand on one leg. A normal 85-year-old individual should be able to stand on that leg for 12 seconds. If you can't do it for 12 seconds, then you have a balance imperfection or a minor imperfection. And it turns out that there are three ways that you can improve your balance very effectively. One of them is racket sports, which make you go to the side. Secondly is dancing. And the third one is Tai Chi. And there was a study done at Emory that people who did Tai Chi for 10 minutes twice a week could decrease their falls by 60% and decrease their fracture rate by 60%. So find a Y in your neighborhood or an adult education program, and Tai Chi is available to almost anybody anywhere in the United States.
Excellent. Thank you. And we had a question from one of our online participants, from Rita. For women on aromatase inhibitors, what specific things can be done to maintain bone mass? So shall I start with Dr. Groner and then Dr. Lane? Dr. Groner, do you want to comment?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think the most important thing is get a baseline assessment of where you are, where you're starting, so that you know whether just the usual calcium, exercise, and vitamin D is sufficient or whether you need drug therapy to maintain bone. So that's really the beginning. And then to monitor it as you stay on the aromatase inhibitors, because even women who have very normal bone mineral density at initiation will lose bone. Now, studies have shown that if your bone mineral density is normal at initiation, you never become osteoporotic, but you still can lose enough to become osteopenic. So I think the important thing is follow your bone mineral density. But I think it's very, very important that we focus on, again, the other factors, calcium, making sure your vitamin D levels are adequate. Exercise is probably the most underused tool that we have. And then all of the options in terms of drug therapy that we mentioned.
I think that...
Dr. Lane?
Yes. There, it's interesting is that people who get fractures not only have it's a question of what their bone density is, but what's the quality of the bone. So that's a little bit more difficult, and we don't have a really good measure of it. So that with all these measurements, if you have had a track record of having had a low-energy fracture, that should be a warning sign, and we should treat you more aggressively than people who don't have a fracture history. I think the DEXA is very important in that measurement. There is, I mentioned, the thing called the FRAX, F-R-A-X. You can look it on your website, and you can run through that even with or without a DEXA, and that will tell you your risk of what chance of getting a fracture. The other point is that there now are laboratory tests that also help the physician, and these are called bone turnover markers. They're found either in the urine or blood tests, and they will give you a peek at the future. So instead of waiting a year or 2 years for a DEXA to change, you can learn within 3 months or 6 months if you really are losing bone. And so if you're at that marginal point, the markers may help the oncologist to decide to be more proactive in your treatment.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question from someone on the phone. And Stephanie, do you want to?
We have a question from Elizabeth N. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I'm interested in an answer regarding the possibility of over-supplementation. I realize I'm taking about 3,500 units of vitamin D from supplements and 1,400 from calcium.
Okay, well, that's an excellent question. Thank you, Elizabeth. I'm going to ask Dr. Lane if you would address that question.
Well, the Institute of Medicine took a good look at this, and their starting point initially is somewhere between a 1,000 and 2,000. So if you're up to 3,500, your doctor should measure your vitamin D level and then adjust your vitamin D based on the value. Now, it may turn out that you do indeed need more than 2,000 units, but if you go over 2,000 units, get a vitamin D value. The same thing is true as about calcium. The normal calcium supplementation is usually somewhere about 800 to 1,000. If you're up to 1,400, again, your physician can do a lab test to measure your calcium value in the blood, plus can look at something like the intact PTH, and with that information can adjust your values. There are problems with taking too much calcium. People get constipated. It's a lot of calcium out there. But there's also issues such as kidney stones. So taking something at high levels without checking could lead to problems, and your doctor should be able to do that for you.
And our next question?
Our next question comes from Irima Kay. Your line is open.
Thank you. I have a question about supplements. I know they're not FDA approved, so how safe are they? And how well they are absorbed by our bodies versus getting calcium from food?
The best way to take calcium is the natural source. But what we usually do is we let you take your calcium from your natural source that you feel comfortable taking, and then take a look and see if there's a shortfall. And then you use only that amount of supplements that will get you up to fill up that shortfall. Now, there are several types of calcium. The one that I prefer is calcium citrate. And the reason I prefer it, it's more easily absorbed than carbonate. And in addition, it prevents kidney stones. So it's a very safe form, and there are many different companies that make calcium citrate. How safe are the supplements? They should be safe as long as you don't overuse. And again, when you're using these agents, discuss this with your physician.
Excellent. And we have a question from Margaret online and who asks really if we could say more about really pain medication for metastatic bone pain. So, Dr. Grana, could you address this in terms of just
I think the key is working with a physician, and it may not necessarily be the oncologist alone. A lot of institutions now have what are known as palliative care or symptom management physicians or pain teams, and the idea is for your oncologist to work with that physician or that team to find the most appropriate strategy. So you typically build on a regimen. So first you begin with non-steroidals, Motrin, Advil, et cetera, Trilocate, et cetera. Then you add a mild narcotic. Then you may add a stronger narcotic. But I don't think you can underestimate the value of some of the procedures. Some people need a nerve block. Some people need an epidural. Some people, again, benefit from focused radiation to a spot that may be causing pressure on a nerve. Some people can benefit from these intravenous radiation treatments, Quadramet. So it really is looking at all of the options available to obtain pain control and to obtain long-term pain control. So, for example, rather than taking a Percocet every 4 to 6 hours, for the patient who needs that pain control, you're often better taking a long-acting narcotic such as MS-Contin, OxyContin, that is taken every 12 hours, or using Duragesic, a fentanyl patch that is placed on the body and removed every 3 days, and you can titrate that to appropriate pain control. It becomes an issue of maintaining good pain control, avoiding over-sedation, and managing some of the other symptoms that come with narcotics, constipation, et cetera. So you really need to work with your team to make sure that the right goals are established.
Excellent. And we have another question, actually, for you, Dr. Grana, from Mildred, in terms of what are the signs of bone metastases, if you could say something about that.
Well, The most common sign of bone metastases is pain. But the thing that I really stress to my patients is that cancer we're seeing cancer at the ages where other diseases also come into play. So if you're in menopause and you have arthritis, you may be having pain from arthritic symptoms. You may have pain from a herniated disc. And it often has to be teased out. So I think for the woman who's developing some symptom, the first thing is to calm herself, because the majority of those symptoms are not bone metastases. The majority of those symptoms may be arthritic symptoms or a herniated disc. And so the key is differentiating that pain. The pain of metastasis tends to be new, different, and unrelenting, whereas the pain of arthritis or a disc, bulging disc, often is exacerbated by a certain activity. If you've been gardening and you have pain, and by the following day the pain is improved or some non-steroidal makes the pain better, it's not metastases. If the pain is persistent, then you need to bring it to your doctor's attention, and testing needs to be done, whether it's a bone scan, a PET scan, an MRI. But again, I find myself talking a lot of women down from symptoms, because it is common at the age of 50s, 60s to have arthritic symptoms, to have pain for a reason or other.
I totally agree, and I think the most common reason for having pain is arthritis or strains.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they should not rush into the diagnosis of cancer. The one thing I would also suggest is sometimes people with a history of breast cancer will then develop a fracture spont, and it may be under low energy. It is important at that point to really take a look at the fracture to make sure the fracture is due to just trauma or bad luck or osteoporosis, and also to be sure to also ask the question, could this be due to a local area of metastasis? So they have to pay attention, and if they're in there, the physician ideally should take a biopsy to help the oncologist answer that particular question. But again, the bottom line is most people who get aches and pains, it's unrelated to the breast cancer.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our participants on the phone.
Our next question comes from Marcia R. Your line is open.
Yes, I take a calcium supplement, and I know that it's important to probably the preferred is the calcium citrate. But a question that I have is I was also told at one time that it should be elemental. And Citracal is the only one that seems readily available to me that actually shows it's elemental. with the calcium citrate. Is that important? And if it is, what exactly is that?
You brought up a key question. Elemental is the amount of calcium within the compound. So the labeling of the bottle should tell you how much calcium is per pill. It shouldn't be just like calcium citrate, which is, a lot of that is citrate. So they have to define what is the actual amount of calcium per pill. The second thing, when you look at your bottle of pills, they often will say one serving will provide a certain amount of calcium. But in small print, they tell you how many pills make the serving. And people don't look at that and often will be taking too little calcium. So read the bottle carefully. You want to know how much calcium per pill, and then accordingly take the right amount of pills depending on your diet.
And we have another question from one of our online participants. Is there a double negative effect on the bones when you take both Femara and Dexilant for GERD at the same time? I'll open that to both Dr. Groner and Dr. Lane.
It was Femara. What was the other agent?
Yeah, Dexilant is Dexilant for GERD.
I can't say that there should be. I mean, clearly the Femara causes bone loss. Whether the Dexilant causes some decreased absorption, I'm not sure. But I would not anticipate a dramatic enhancement of loss. But honestly, this is not something I could really answer well.
I have no further to comment about that.
But this is an excellent question. We would then invite you. It's a good place to practice your questions. It's a great place to ask a question. I would definitely take it back to your treating healthcare team. And you also, many people also will check with their pharmacist to see if there's any, what you're really asking about, I think, is the drug interaction or do they have any impact in terms of on your bones. So you could also ask your pharmacist, but you definitely should take it back to your oncologist who then would really kind of research this and whoever's, you know, diagnosed your GERD in terms of also letting them know that you're on Femara as well. So everybody works together. Ideally, your oncologist would talk to the doctor who's treating you for your GERD as well. And the pharmacist.
Carolyn, there's one other thing about this. For a lot of people who take for GERD take a lot of medications to ease the problem. And what they do is they lower the acidity in the stomach, among other things. These will inhibit, to some degree, the amount of calcium you take in. So that you may need to take a little bit more calcium if you're on agents that are directed at indigestion and GERD. And your doctor should just check that, in fact, you're getting what you think you're getting. You may have to do a little, take a little more material or pick the timing a little bit better for when you take your calcium supplementation.
Excellent. And here's another question. It's different, but it's, and this is from Rita, are there certain foods that create an acid load in the body and prevent calcium absorption? Is drinking coffee okay? Dr. Lane, do you want to try that one?
Coffee. It's just the question is, how much liquid are you taking? Because you can wash out your calcium. And are you avoiding taking things which have dairy products in them? That's more of a problem with younger people. You know, people will drink tea, coffee, or take sodas instead of taking calcium-loaded food, and that's much more common in the younger individuals. Older individuals have a tendency to take less milk because sometimes they lose the ability to handle the milk products adequately. So I think coffee is all right unless you're up to, you know, 8 or 10 cups. I think a few cups of coffee a day are not going to cause a particular problem.
That is actually getting a lot of any issue with coffee and breast cancer, Dr. Lane. Dr. Groner, I'm sorry.
No, there actually has not been any data. There have been a couple of studies that actually have suggested that it may be protective. I'm not sure what mechanism I could even begin to speculate would be effective, but I don't think there's any convincing evidence in either direction, either that it's protective or harmful. And I tell people that, as everything, moderation. The one thing that coffee may be harmful for, however, is the hot flashes and night sweats that many breast cancer patients have as a result of menopause and their hormonal therapy. caffeine and alcohol are two of the biggest stressors when it comes to being triggers for hot flashes and night sweats and poor sleep. So again, if you're having some of those symptoms, you might want to look at and try to see if you can tease out whether that may be a contributing factor from these.
That's an excellent point, Bob. Thank you. And there's another question actually from one of our online participants just about the person is having a really hard time with developing an exercise regimen and routine, and just any recommendations. In other words, they're actually indicating in detail, as much as they try, it's hard for them to build an exercise every day. And I'm sure you both heard that, and I wonder if there are things that you both recommend to people to do to make that more a part of their lives.
I think I'll start by saying that as a woman and as a working woman, I do find it incredibly difficult to build in the time. Yet more and more we're learning that even as little as 30 minutes of walking can be, 30 minutes of walking three times a week can be important for Alzheimer's, the benefits in bone, the benefits in terms of dealing with hot flashes and night sweats, the benefits potentially leading to decreased risk of recurrence from exercise and dietary changes. So I think it's very, very important. Seek out resources in your community. The YMCA often has programs. Some are partnering with the Lance Armstrong Foundation to provide free services or at lower cost services for patients. There may be gyms in your area, trainers in your area. So seek out resources, but it becomes very, very important to make this a priority, yet one of the hardest things to achieve.
A lot of times in life you can say, where are there opportunities? Could you walk to work? Could you take the stairs rather than taking the elevator? Looking at everything, do you park next to the supermarket or even in the supermarket, or could you park at the other end of the parking lot and make a little bit of an effort in it? So I think if you can just look at all those little things over the course of the day where you could do a little bit more would be advantage. The other thing is to find something you really enjoy. Make it fun. And if you do something, it is an activity that you particularly like, take full advantage of that that activity. And then finally, some people don't do exercise because it hurts. They have aches and pains. And the best place to do that is to get into a pool because you don't weigh anything in water, and yet you can still go through a good range of motion and do activities in that. And I try to find the areas, if you have aches and pains, you may want to take a non-steroidal before you do your exercise. But make it a part of your life, you know, just like you brush your teeth, do something every day that gives you a little effort.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our telephone participants.
Our next question comes from Gladys H. Your line is open.
I would like to know what Dr. Lane thinks about the British Medical Journal study that correlated use of calcium with more cardiovascular events.
Well, there's been a series of studies, and it's very difficult. They've gone over, there are studies that have been done from New Zealand, the Australian studies, there are a bunch of studies that kind of wax and wane about the issue about cardiac disease. And I think the safest thing is initially is to talk to your doctor. You know, just get a sense, do I have risk factors that raise an issue? And secondly, I think you definitely need some calcium. And what I've done is I make a patient-centric choice. I pick the calcium for the individual, not the general dose, but the individual. And again, what I've turned to is I've used the intact PTH. If your parathyroid gland, which is your own monitor, is looking at your own calcium, if that's high, your body is saying, I don't have enough calcium in the system, and that's deleterious to your body. So there are signals within your body that can help the physician pick a dose that you would be comfortable basically with. And if you're a cardiologist or somebody's really concerned about risk factors, then listen to your doctor because he or she's been thinking about this.
Excellent. Thank you. Now we have a question from one of our online participants, from Carol, and her question is, I have been taking Arimidex for 15 months, and my DEXA scan at baseline was normal. My recent DEXA scan shows a bone loss of 13% and osteopenia. Is there a loss that would cause you to, stop the Arimidex entirely or try the Fosamax type approach first? I'm taking 1,200 milligrams of calcium, 5,000 units of vitamin D with constant monitoring with my doctor, and I'm doing weightlifting and walking 5 times per week. So I'm going to leave that question both to both Dr. Lane and Dr. Grana to address.
So I'll give you the oncologist's view of this. This is clearly a patient that's been managed very well, and you've demonstrated a loss, and you've demonstrated a significant loss, and this is the patient not that I would change from an aromatase inhibitor, but that I would simply add bone-targeted therapy. So I would either add an oral bisphosphonate or think about adding Prolia. Prolia now is approved, FDA-approved, for aromatase inhibitor-induced bone loss. So I would pick one of those two, whichever is most acceptable to the woman. Again, first making sure that her bone, her teeth are in good health and don't need any extractions or other things. Having said that, we know tamoxifen is better for bone, whereas the aromatase inhibitors cause bone loss. Tamoxifen tends to be a bone-strengthening compound. It's a serum. You know that Evista is FDA-approved for treatment of osteoporosis and osteopenia, and tamoxifen is a serum like Evista is a serum. So it is an option, but again, I think there's still relatively good data that the aromatase inhibitors have slight improvement over tamoxifen when it comes to anti-cancer activity. So I would not use this amount of bone loss to make a change.
I agree totally with what you've recommended. And I think the priority is take care of the breast cancer. And then there are plenty of agents that we can use to protect you if it becomes available. So there are drugs which will protect the skeleton in the continued use of the aromatase inhibitors.
Now, the other thing that's been shown is that the bone loss that happens with the aromatase inhibitors tends to be greatest early on in the course of therapy, tends to plateau as you move forward at the end, and then once you finish the aromatase inhibitor at 5 years of therapy, once you discontinue it, you stop the bone loss and you actually start to see an improvement in bone. So that's also an encouraging thing for women.
That's excellent. Can you say more about that? That's very interesting.
Again, I think it's purely saying that these drugs have a detrimental effect on bone, that they really do cause bone loss, and the minute you stop the drug because you've completed your therapy, that loss is abolished and the bone goes back to its healthy place. Now, it's a problem because there's a study going on in the United States, so we think we'll have results in the next few years looking at 10 years of aromatase inhibitor therapy versus 5. It's a study called NSABP B42. So if that study shows that 10 years is better than 5, then we are going to have to really be focusing on bone for the long term. Part of what that study will look at is not just risk of recurrence of breast cancer, but also what's happening to bone, what's happening to cardiovascular disease, et cetera. So it may be that we will have some better answers in the future.
Can I ask you about the aromatase and the bone loss? If you see a lot of bone loss, then the drug is really working because it must be eliminating the estrogen in the patient.
Potentially it may be. I'm not sure that that's been looked at that carefully, though.
Yeah.
Well, this has been an amazing call. I want to thank both Dr. Groner and Dr. Lane. You're always so superb. This has been an incredible call. I want to thank all of you who've asked such wonderful questions. And all of you have been listening as well. And I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour education program and that when we plan a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to review with you all the services that you can access from Cancer Care so that when the call ends, you don't feel like you're just left out there alone, that you now have a connection to us and that we're here for you throughout the course of any needs that you may have. And if you didn't get to ask your question today, please do call us after the call as well. Now, Cancer Care has a staff of 35 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we are here to provide a host of services. And you can call us by calling 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And the services that we offer include just a chance to talk to a social worker about your concerns. And we also, of course, offer support groups, both on the telephone and online. We also offer practical and financial assistance, which can be an enormous help to many of you on the call, linking you up to resources, providing help to you. That's very important to each of you. We also have a co-payment assistance program. So we have lots of different services that you can access. And, of course, we do many of these workshops on the telephone and online. And we, of course, have various materials, booklets and fact sheets. So I would say definitely do call us if you have any questions or concerns. And most importantly, we would not want anyone to leave today's program feeling that you are alone. We want you to know that you're part now of a community of support, and we're totally accessible to you, really, by phone, 1-800-813-HOPE, or visiting our website at www.cancercare.org. And our website is actually full of information for you. And I have to say that our website also replays, has what we call podcasts, of these live programs that you can listen to, so that you can go and look at all the programs we've done in the past and listen to them if you wish, and also look at our calendar for upcoming programs. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.